I believe that it is important for all of us to understand how fear can motivate our actions. What we are afraid of can be a powerful motivator. We all have some fears. I have definitely some fears. I have fears that I've had to deal with as your minister. One of my fears is how much I speak out, how much I should push when we face issues that challenge the comfort of this mostly white, mostly financially comfortable, mostly liberal congregation. One of the reasons I struggle with this as your minister is because I struggle with this as myself. Same reasons. The systems under which I live, under which we live, especially those which allow us to live in comfort, while others are victims of oppression or violence, poverty, and injustice, should be challenged on a fairly regular basis. And the heightened awareness of that injustice happening right now in this country is important if we are really going to live our UU principles and ideals. There have been a lot of blog posts and articles written this past week following the events in Baltimore, and quite frankly, it's been hard for me to keep up. There are a couple that I read, and I thought a few of them had important things to say. One of the ones I'm going to share with you is titled, Why It's So Hard to Talk to White People About Racism. It's written by Robin DiAngelo. She's an associate professor of critical, multicultural, and social justice education at Westfield State University, a university, by the way, founded by a Unitarian church member, Horace Mann, who was a pioneer of education in the United States. So anyway, she says, any white person living in the United States will develop opinions about race simply by swimming in the water of our culture. But mainstream sources, schools, textbooks, media, don't provide us with the multiple perspectives that we need. Yes, we will develop strong, emotionally laden opinions, but they will not be informed opinions. Our socialization renders us racially illiterate. When you add a lack of humility to that illiteracy because we don't know what we don't know, you get the breakdown we so often see when trying to engage white people in meaningful conversations about race. Mainstream dictionary definitions reduce racism to individual racial prejudice and the intentional actions that result. The people that commit these intentional acts are deemed bad, and those that don't, good. If we are against racism and unaware of committing racist acts, we can't be racists. Racism and being a good person have become mutually exclusive. But this definition does little to explain how racial hierarchies are constantly reproduced. And by constantly reproduced, I believe that she's saying that racial hierarchies are systems. And we're not always conscious of these systems, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist. And she goes on to say that, and it helps us further understand these systems when she says, social scientists understand racism as multidimensional and highly adaptive, something I've talked about from the pulpit before, a system that ensures an unequal distribution of resources between racial groups. Because whites built and dominate all significant institutions, often at the expense of and on the uncompensated labor of other groups. And their interests are embedded in the foundation of U.S. society. And while individual whites may be against racism, they still benefit from the distribution of resources controlled by the group. Yes, an individual person of color can sit at the tables of power, but the overwhelming majority of decision makers will be white. Yes, white people can have problems and face barriers, but systemic racism won't be one of them. This distinction between individual prejudice and systems of unequal institutionalized racial power is fundamental. One cannot understand how racism functions in the U.S. today if one ignores group power relations. The systemic and institutional control allows those of us who are white in North America to live in a social environment that protects and insulates us from race-based stress. And we've organized society to reproduce and reinforce our racial interests and perspectives. Further, we are centered in all matters deemed normal, universal, benign, neutral, and good. Thus, we move through this wholly racialized world with an unracialized identity. In other words, white people can represent all of humanity, but people of color can only represent their racial selves. And challenges to this identity become highly stressful and intolerable. In my opinion, the stress and intolerability often cause these systems to revert to fear in order to maintain order. They're coming for your job. If you let them move into your neighborhood, the crime rate will go up. If you let them vote, they're going to take over. These are all statements that have been used to separate us, to make us think that we are so fundamentally different that we can't and shouldn't coexist. And it's not just about black and white. It's about other and the other. And more frequently than not, it's not about white. It's about a person of color. It's someone who has an accent. It's someone who may not have a similar education level. Fear has been used as a motivator in political systems of power for years. In an article in Salon Magazine titled America's Long History of Immigrant Scaremongering, the author notes that on the morning of the 19th of May, 1900, the Chinese community of San Francisco found itself under siege in the name of state and municipal security. It was not fear of bombs or terrorist attack that inspired officials to commit a wholesale violation of civil liberties that morning. It was fear of disease, specifically bubonic plague. And that wasn't the first time San Francisco's Chinatown had been quarantined. And it wouldn't be the last, nor was it a surprise. Local authorities long regarded Chinese immigrants as a threat to public health and a manifestation of long-standing nativist fears. The Irish were charged with bringing cholera to the United States in 1832. Later, the Italians were stigmatized for polio, and tuberculosis was called the Jewish disease. The entire discourse of the 19th and 20th century politics was saturated with attacks on immigrants as diseased intruders to the body politic. Indeed, the dialogue culminated in the Wisdom of Congress, I say that tongue-in-cheek, in 1891, with a revision of the 1882 Immigration Act, excluding persons suffering from a loathsome and dangerous contagious disease from entry into the United States. Fear has been used in politics, and it's been used in immigration, and it's been used in race relations for a very long time. I left Selma with a pin someone gave me that I really wanted to wear this morning and left on my bedside table. It says, Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. And I just had this transformative experience where we heard about the incredible progress that had been made and the very difficult challenges to come. And I thought the least I could do is wear that pin on my trip home to liberal California from the South. And then, as I wore it, I will tell you that the wearing of this button made me very self-conscious of my own whiteness and my liberal social and political beliefs. And it did bring some comments, and it brought some stares. And most of the comments were from people of color, who on a couple of occasions seemed much more willing to engage me in conversation about the recent deaths in the news, as opposed to the quiet stares from white people, none of whom engaged me in conversation. Part of my own personal reflection on wearing the button is to reflect on what level I personally should play to be involved and how much skin I should have in the game. I certainly don't think wearing a button is enough. So should I march in solidarity down in San Diego? Should I fly to Baltimore and march in solidarity with them? Is delivering this sermon enough? I know at some point reflecting must lead to more action than wearing a button. And since I put that button on, there have been more high-profile deaths of black men at the hands of law enforcement. And at times, as a white ally, I struggle with how to respond when these tragic events occur. Part of the reason I struggle is, although each death has its own individual scenario, as we've come to know, it's framed by the omnipresent and oppressive systems of privilege and economic subjugation and ever-evolving racism, and it can feel so overwhelming. Among the many posts and articles that I've been coming flying through my awareness this week, there's lots of opinions about how to be a best ally. And I mean by that an ally to the African-American community. I've read many, and there are suggestions that I'm going to take from that. I know many who have taken many suggestions to heart, and they're trying to figure out how to be the best ally. I know those who've marched, flown from here, and marched on the streets of Ferguson. People I know who've flown from here. I know those who've stopped traffic on the major freeways on I-5 in protests. I know many who have joined local faith efforts. But even though I know those who've taken action, I feel like we still struggle, often from a place of our own discomfort and our own privilege, to respond to the systemic nature of oppression and fear that we deal with in ourselves. I've actually seen a couple articles this week that basically said, I wish white liberals would stop quoting Dr. King. Something white liberals of my generation do often, as I do. They said that because they said he isn't here and he ain't coming back. And there's a new generation addressing these systems of power. The Black Lives Matter movement, hashtag Black Lives Matter, was created in 2012 after Trayvon Martin was murdered and George Zimmerman was acquitted. And according to the movement website, now these are their words, so I want you to listen to their words. It was rooted in the experiences of black people in this country who actively resisted our dehumanization. Hashtag Black Lives Matter is a call to action in response to the virulent anti-black racism that permeates our society. Black Lives Matter is a unique contribution that goes beyond extrajudicial killings of black people by police and vigilantes. It goes beyond the narrow nationalism that can be prevalent within the black communities, which merely call on black people to love black, live black, buy black, keeping straight black men in the front of the movement, while our sisters, queer and trans and disabled folk, take up roles in the background or not at all. Black Lives Matter affirm the lives of black, queer, and trans folks, disabled folks, black undocumented folks, folks with records, women with all black lives along, and all black lives along the gender spectrum. I met one of the women who started this movement. She describes herself as a queer black woman. It centers those that have been marginalized within black liberation movements. It is a tactic to rebuild black liberation. And when we say Black Lives Matter, we're broadening the conversation around state violence. These are their words, to include all of the ways in which black people are intentionally left powerless at the hands of the state. We're talking about ways in which black lives are deprived of basic human rights and dignity. How black poverty and genocide is state violence. How 2.8 million black people all locked in cages in this country is state violence. How black women bearing the burden of relentless assault on our children and our families is state violence. How black queer and trans folks bear a unique burden from heteropatriarchal society that deposes us like garbage and simultaneously fetishes us and profits off of us, and that is state violence. How 500,000 black people in the U.S. are undocumented immigrants and relegated to the shadows. How black girls are used as negotiating chips during times of conflict and war. How black folks living with disabilities and differing abilities bear the burden of state-sponsored Darwinist experiments that attempt to squeeze us into boxes of normality defined by white supremacy. And that is state violence. I remember when we had a discussion here at UUFSD about reading our welcoming statement that we often read at the beginning of the service and the use of the word queer. some folks found the word offensive. They knew it from when it was used as a racial slur for people who identified as gay. I don't blame them for that. That was what happened in their time. And after some discussion, I gave in to not using the word, mostly because of my fear about offending the straight, white, liberal folks in our congregation. What I didn't consider strongly enough was that those who self-identify as queer, being able to come to this congregation and recognize themselves in this religious community and hear the identification specifically lifted up, specifically spoken to everyone in our welcoming, in a way that they knew that they were seen for how they identify themselves, and that we here at UUFSD had to get over our own fears and anxiety about the word and welcome them with open arms. That's because it's about them and not about us. And actually saying them and us others them. It's all about being seen for who we all are. It shouldn't be about a system that others are trying to adapt to our system all the time. It's the same with my understanding of Black Lives Matter. It's about a movement specifically naming and the victims and the systems. The victims and the systems. It's not devaluing all lives. There's been a lot of conversation about Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter. Yes, all lives matter, but we're lifting up the systemic oppression of a community of people who for generations have and continue to suffer at the hands of a system they didn't build, at a system they don't maintain, and the use of fear that keeps us separate. With the explosion of emotions around the death of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old Baltimore man who sustained fatal injuries while in police custody, another thing that I read that resonated with me was written by the Baltimore Orioles baseball team executive vice president John Angelos. He said, "My greater source of personal concern, outrage, and sympathy beyond this particular case is focused neither upon one night's property damage nor upon acts, but is focused rather upon the past four-decade period during which an American political elite have shipped middle-class jobs and working-class jobs away from Baltimore and cities and towns around the U.S. to third-world dictatorships like China and others, plunging tens of millions of good, hard-working Americans into economic devastation. And then followed that action around the nation by diminishing every American's civil rights protections in order to control an unfairly impoverished population living under an ever-declining standard of living and suffering at the butt end of an ever more militarized and aggressive surveillance state." Vice President of the Baltimore Orioles. I don't exactly know how to tell you to become good allies, although there's a lot of material and suggestions on how. I don't exactly know how to tell you to best help break down systems of oppression and power and fear, although there are all kinds of UUA programs and others that could help us learn. What I do know is that we are responsible as anyone else. We individually are responsible as anyone else in understanding our own participation in these systems. It's not up to the victims of the systems to teach us. We are responsible. We are responsible as anyone else to examine how we might make our own choices based in our own fears. And we are responsible as anyone else to commit to doing something and to help change what happens next. We are. May that be so.